Senator Lindsey Graham passed away this weekend. Our condolences to his friends and family. The South Carolina Republican spent more than 20 years in the Senate, and during that time, he was one of the Republican Party's loudest foreign policy hawks. So today, we're going to talk about his legacy, his unusual relationship with President Trump, and whether Graham was the missing link between MAGA and neoconservatism. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman. And today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Matt, I want to start with you because more than anything else, Lindsey Graham was a hawk, right? Like he was just somebody who never met a war that he didn't want to start or increase in some way, right? He was a committed foreign policy interventionist, a kind of a true neoconservative, even as the party moved away from that brand under Trump. And a lot of that goes back to Graham's relationship with Senator John McCain. Graham was a kind of McCain understudy, right? He was a John McCain mini-me. And you wrote a book about John McCain. So help us understand that relationship and how it defined Graham's career.
I mean, it was the three amigos between McCain and Lindsey Graham and Joseph Lieberman, all of whom were kind of hyper-interventionists in every single sense of the word. If there was anything that was going to get in the way of the mission of using the U.S. military to spread freedom and punish America's enemies, then that thing needed to be removed as an obstacle. So, for example, Lindsey Graham would talk about how he would like to ban not just flag burning, but Koran burning, because that just causes problems. And also anyone protesting at military funerals. Like the First Amendment to him was not an obstacle to his goal. Everything he did, including his heel turn in his relationship with Donald Trump, is completely comprehensible within that scope. He wanted to have influence on the policies that he cared about the most. And the price of doing that over the last 10 years is to be pretty obsequious, not totally, but mostly to the point of where you're saying that Donald Trump is the best president of all time. This is a person he described as a xenophobic bigot and the worst GOP nominee in his life.
Can we get the complete Lindsey Graham ranking, like worst to best and like who's in the middle?
Yeah.
No, because it would change like according to the political winds and what's possible. Yeah. That's why a lot of
James Buchanan is number two on his top 10 list. So.
It's always James K. Polk, you know, like if you're going to expand the territory, you got to vote in Lindsey. I think, I think a lot of people try to, come up with an intrigue explanation for why he changed his mind. I don't think it's that really complicated. It's similar to why Mike Lee changed his mind or the House Freedom Caucus changed their minds or even the Libertarian Party in a way for a while changed their minds about Donald Trump is because proximity to power and the temptations to want to shape that power. That's who Lindsey Graham was.
So Lindsey Graham told Mark Leibovich of The Atlantic about Trump. This is a quote from Lindsey Graham to The Atlantic. If you flatter him, that's Trump. If you flatter him all the time, he'll lose respect for you. Graham told me of the president. If he had a goal of getting Trump to do something, especially if it involved foreign affairs, Graham would just tell the president that his then predecessor, Barack Obama, would do something that was 180 degrees different. This method, quote, can be very effective, Graham told me, again to Leibovich. Obama drives him nuts, right? So he was just a master manipulator here, right? Like this was almost entirely cynical, as far as I can tell. Nick, what do you think about Graham's relationship with Trump? I mean, he was a fierce critic of Trump very early on and then just flipped 180.
In keeping with what Matt was talking about, if Graham was actually doing all of this as a public display in order to play Trump, it's deeply disturbing. Because, Trump humiliated him. I mean, he basically stopped just short of putting him in a rubber suit with a zipper mask and parading him around. Trump came around to becoming a hawk on foreign policy, which is not good. So it's like, if we want to say that Lindsey Graham was effective in changing Trump into a hawk, that's bad for the country. I looked at a bunch of coverage from the late aughts when there was still some discussion of budget, responsibility in America. And Lindsey Graham was the leading voice who was pissing his pants over sequestration, which was a minor reduction of about $55 billion from a Pentagon budget that which was then misleadingly labeled as around $500 billion or something like that. And he went bananas saying that this would destroy the ability of America to defend itself. So in that sense, I mean, you know, I say nothing about the guy as a person because I don't know him or anything, but his hawkishness was bad for the country, however heartfelt it was. He was also a massive champion of a growing surveillance state in the name of national defense. And then he was kind of cretinous in the way that he dealt with Donald Trump in the presidency. So it's hard to see, you know, having more people in power like Lindsey Graham does not help America become or stay great, I suppose.
Catherine, Matt's point is that Graham was so hawkish they didn't care about free speech or the First Amendment. Nick's point is Graham was so hawkish he didn't care about the budget, the debt, the deficit. And then Nick also mentioned this surveillance thing, because it also seems like Graham was so hawkish that he didn't care about Americans' privacy. I mean, he was really one of the key architects of the post-9/11 surveillance state.
Yeah, I had a discussion with some recent staffers about the substance and tone in which we might eulogize him. And I learned a rule from a colleague, which I like a lot, which is don't say anything after someone died that you didn't say while they were alive. But we have said some really mean stuff about Lindsey Graham during his life. And so I feel on firm ground about saying that he was really, really bad for America. Everything he did was bad. The surveillance state stuff is underappreciated because he did so much else that was bad for America. But Matthew Petty, who wrote an obit for him this morning, noted that he died doing what he loved, egging on faraway violence. And I think that's about right. And I feel sad for the people who loved him. But our message now is what our message was when he was alive, which was that dude kind of sucked.
Well, Catherine and Matt, sorry, I mean, just Catherine, you said that everything he did was bad. And I actually want to ask a follow-up about that, because he also chaired the Judiciary Committee and helped confirm a lot of judges, hundreds of judges. And this was partly a partisan strategy, but it also ended up with a lot of judges who we would say are people we would prefer to have maybe than the alternative, say if a Democrat had been in charge of the Judiciary Committee. Does anybody here think, first of all, what do we just think about the judge's strategy that he helped execute? But then also, does anybody here have anything nice to say about Lindsey Graham, not just as a person, but like as a senator, as somebody who played a major role in American politics for 20 something years?
I love it that you're like, is our obituary for Lindsey Graham, he sucked, but Gorsuch? Like, is that the question?
I mean, that's the summary of an awful lot of American politics for the last 10 years or so.
That's not wrong.
I mean, the thing that made him effective was that he had a pretty famous wit. He was good at that thing that we ask senators to do, which is to go on Meet the Press. Literally decided on the last day of his life not to
so good it killed him,
because he wanted to go on Meet the Press yet again to talk about Ukraine and Russia and the things. And it should be stated, because it's still true, that the types of Republicans that the establishment press prefer are almost always interventionists. And they are never asked to say, hey, you supported, you know, tripling down in Afghanistan in 2019. He's the guy who talked Donald Trump as much as anybody else out of withdrawing from Afghanistan in 2019. And, you know, he was talking about finishing the job in Afghanistan in 2019. Like, no one ever said, dude, none of the jobs got finished to him. But he was a famous wit. Al Franken said he was the funniest guy in the Senate by far. If he was on your side and he delivered a one-liner, you're like, man, that moral clarity, and he's funny. And if you weren't on his side, you're like, my God, that was some hyperbolic bullshit. Holy cow, what are we even doing here? But that was a talent at the very least.
Monica Lewinsky eulogized him by noting that he was one of the managers of the impeachment against Bill Clinton, and that he went out of his way to show the machinations of the Clinton administration to smear her and lie about her. And that's, you know, that's good. I don't know that the impeachment was... You know, I haven't thought about it in a long time. But like, you know, whenever you are revealing that people in power are orchestrating false statements about somebody, you know, that's to the good.
So bad, but Gorsuch, Catherine, that's our conclusion.
I guess so.
All right. Well, I guess we'll move on then. Let's talk about something Lindsey Graham would be happy that we're talking about. Iran, because about a month ago, we've had this war going on for months, right? But then a month ago, Trump said there was a ceasefire. A big part of that ceasefire was, according to Trump at the time, that the Strait of Hormuz was going to be open with no tolls. That was an absolute promise that he made. And then last week, that didn't happen. We launched new strikes on Iran. Trump says the ceasefire is over. And the Strait of Hormuz, Catherine, so normally this is the part of the show where I ask you, is the Strait of Hormuz open? And I do want to know, but I also, I want to frame this with, we were chatting on Slack, and I did ask her permission to share this with everybody. We were chatting on Slack before the show started, and you said something about the new development that we heard from Trump this morning about what's going on with the Strait of Hormuz. You want to tell us what you said and what that was in relationship to?
So we've discussed the fact that this is like a weekend war, maybe like we do the war and then on Monday we wrap it up in time for markets to open. But this Monday, I guess, a few minutes before we started taping, we got the announcement that maybe there will be 20% of all cargo shipped will be a toll for the U.S. Very complicated. And
Trump went on Fox and Friends, and what he said was, we're going to take control of the Strait of Hormuz.
Right.
He's just announcing this like it's a real thing. It's like, we're going to bomb them until they stop, until Iran stops attacking ships there. We're going to take control of it. And what he said was, we're going to take a 20% fee, the United States, I guess, or maybe Donald Trump himself. Who knows? You can pay it in Trump coin.
I think it's Tiffany is going to be.
And then he said, we're going to hit them very hard and keep the strait and probably run it. So that's, I guess, as of this morning, our policy with respect to the Strait of Hormuz. And when Suderman sent me this right before the episode, I just said, fuck this shit. And that is how I feel about it. Like, I can't. Nothing's real. Nothing in this news story is real. And yet it is very real from the perspective of trying to conduct orderly global trade and have rule of law.
There's a real war also with real bombs. And also, we kind of took control of Venezuela, right? Marco Rubio is running it now. There is a story in the New York Times about how basically everything in that government is running through Venezuela. So, Matt, do you think we're going to end up running the Strait of Hormuz? Is this going to be Marco Rubio's project number 17 here? Are we going to get more memes about this because he's going to be the toll master?
I doubt it very strongly, not at least of which because 3 weeks ago, Marco Rubio said flatly in front of cameras, there is no such thing as charging a toll on a maritime passageway in the world.
Yeah, but Trump says otherwise now. So doesn't that mean Marco Rubio just flips? Like Lindsey Graham just flipped?
It's possible, but I think it's also too big of a logistical challenge for the Navy and Air Force to do this. If we could have done this, we would have done this. And the type of like constant battle that would require would prove too costly politically to Donald Trump and the Republican Party. I don't think there's appetite for it. Maybe there's this magic wand that suddenly will work this time, but it seems highly doubtful. I think what's happening is that we've climbed down from the ceasefire, and I think the ceasefire had a lot of onerous terms that I'm glad to not see in effect. I think the ceasefire shouldn't have anything to do with relations between Israel and Lebanon, for example, because it's not about Israel and Lebanon. But you're going to see a climb down from it and just kind of this ever reducing stalemate where both sides reserve the right to occasionally bomb one another and say that they're terrible and we're going to destroy everything without really the appetite to do it. And then meanwhile, there is already a very frantic attempt around the world, around the region, to come up with workarounds and pipelines that go through Saudi Arabia, other types of infrastructure to get the oil out. I think it's not, there's something ironic about a president who loves tariffs and who wanted to devolve into spheres of regional influence, overseeing, at least for a little bit, the kind of destruction of a century-long norm that worldwide shipping shall be free. It's a sad state of affairs, and it kind of seems to be where we're at.
Nick, is what Matt is describing kind of sounds like a forever war, exactly the kind of forever war that Trump ran against.
Or forever peace, right?
Right.
Yeah. Forever peace.
We're forever at ceasefire until we're not on Monday morning. Right. And this was, I go back to this moment. Trump's breakout moment in the Republican primary in 2015-16 was in South Carolina, in Lindsey Graham's state, right? When he was like, no, Bush didn't keep us safe. You got us into a bunch of interminable wars forever. And that was the moment when, look, Trump was already running ahead on the polls, but that was at the moment when he kind of clarified he's a real leader in the Republican race because he ran on against the kind of thing that he has gotten us into now.
Yeah, so in the most militarized state in the country. I mean, you know, you go to South Carolina to prove that you are a warrior and you can lead the armed forces and things like that.
So how do we get out of this?
I don't know. I mean, I suspect that a big part of it is that in the midterms, which who knows what they're going to look like. And I know we'll be talking about them a little bit later in the show, but the Republicans are going to lose power and clout in the midterms at the very least. We don't know by how much. And I think a lot of this will be resolved the minute that Donald Trump is officially recognized by the Republican Party as a lame duck, because people are going to start figuring out how they get off that boat, that sinking ship, and swim someplace that'll be a little bit better for them in 2028, either as, you know, House candidates, Senate candidates, or as presidential candidates. But it's deeply disturbing because, you know, it's one thing to kind of like have fun with Trump and his, his mood swings and his pronouncements. But, you know, he is getting further and further away from basic reality testing. And he really seems to be thinking that if I say it, it's the truth. And, you know, this, we're talking about a story that emanates from a Truth Social post, which itself is incoherent. And then when you factor it into his cabinet or politics or geopolitics or international, you know, rule of law and things like that, it just gets more and more troubling.
Catherine, it's been a few minutes. Is the Strait of Hormuz open now? No, the thing I actually want to know from you is how much do we blame Lindsey Graham for this? Because this is obviously Trump's war. Trump, more than any other single individual, is specifically and personally responsible for getting us into this interminable war in Iran that he keeps saying is over, and then it's obviously not over, except maybe it is because it's Monday. But Lindsey Graham was a cheerleader for this war specifically, and for this kind of war for his entire career.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I actually have in mind is, so the 25th anniversary of 9/11 is coming up, and we commissioned a couple of articles for the print magazine about it. And one of the big arguments that we make is, you know, yes, 9/11 changed everything, but also what it really did was just accelerate a bunch of pre-existing trends and hopes and ambitions from the more interventionist and warlike elements of the American foreign policy establishment. And that, you know, Lindsey Graham was a core player in that forever. And he played that role. He played that role, I am sure, in some way in the Iran decision making process. As you say, you really can't overstate the extent to which it's just like Trump does stuff. And so that's the main thing that's happening. Trump often does stuff because
of something he heard on the phone with somebody recently. And one thing that we know about Lindsey Graham is he was on the phone with Donald Trump all the time. He was golfing with Donald Trump all the time. And a big part of what he did with, you know, the flattery, with the, you know, hey, Obama would have done the opposite, was he did this to preserve his access and his influence with the president, specifically on foreign policy matters.
Yeah. And that's, you know, almost everyone in Washington who is on the right, broadly conceived, did that. Almost everyone in Washington over the last 10 years has compromised his principles to stay in line with the Trump administration, or they are gone from Washington. All the people who didn't do that are gone now. So Lindsey Graham just did it better than most.
Matt, is Lindsey Graham like the missing link here between neoconservatism and MAGA, right? Because in some ways we have seen sort of this big transition in the Republican Party over the last 20 years, in particular a big break when Trump became the nominee and then the president, right? And Trump was running against the kind of old neoconservative consensus. And Lindsey Graham is the guy, it seems to me, who figured out how to combine those two things, how to blend the old, you know, Weekly Standard, sorry, Catherine, like the old Weekly Standard kind of neoconservative Bush era hawkishness on everything with the new world of Trump MAGA politics.
I mean, Marco Rubio is the best exemplar more than Lindsey Graham because he actually runs half of the government and all of that.
Not just ours.
And soon to be Cuba's governments. Yeah. So like he's found a way. Marco Rubio is a very staunch interventionist and comes even more passionately, at least when it comes to the Western hemisphere, about the people who are trapped in these bad countries. And he has a sort of he also, like Lindsey Graham, has a gift of gab and can speak passionately about these things. And he's figured out a way to be an operator under Trump and also to just sort of swallow what he probably clearly believes about things. You know, the thing that always frustrates me about Lindsey Graham and Marco Rubio and interventionists and the people who cheer them on and don't look the other way is that what are they saying now? Look at Mark Levin. Not that he's a very important person, but he's big in media at least. He's like, well, okay, great. Now that the Strait of Hormuz is not open or whatever it is, oh, that means that we should go and finish the job. They're still playing finish the job after all of these years and not being reflective about how you can't just use this huge big machine to solve these long-term foreign policy goals. It rarely works that way. And people don't steadfastly learn that lesson. And so Lindsey's gone. Marco Rubio still lives with us and is exerting a lot of influence in foreign policy. And there's a superstructure of interventionists who are determined not to learn the lesson that's unfolding right in front of them.
Yeah. And it's just to add on that very quickly, part of the problem is that Lindsey Graham, he equated, a foreign policy success or foreign policy with building up the military to constantly increasing levels and using the military in different types of ways. What was interesting about Trump is that he was going to change at least that part of it. And instead, what we get is a complete shredding of diplomacy. There's not even a pretense of that. There's also no trade policy that makes sense. He is alienated our allies more than our enemies, because we do more trade with our allies than our enemies. And now all he talks about is how much more he's going to spend on the military and how good he is at deploying it in various places. So, I think the responsibility is fully Trump's, because none of these people matter absent him. But we are in, you know, like a bizarro world of 2016, and it's not going to come out well.
All right, let's finish the job of this segment and move on to some non-foreign policy news. Congress passed a big housing bill, and last week it finally became law. The bill is sort of a hodgepodge. There's just like a bunch of provisions that have kind of been sitting around on the shelf waiting for somebody to do something with them. Catherine, do you want to tell us a little bit about what is in it and if it's going to bring down housing costs?
Listen, the bar is in hell, but I am really proud of Congress for passing a law. Like, I really am. They did it. They took a cluster of related policy matters on a single subject and they debated them and they put them into a bill and then they passed the bill. Admittedly, Trump, whatever, did his weird thing where he was like, I'm not going to sign it, but you can have it, but I'm not going to sign it. Fine. The bill itself is kind of meh. Like, it's, as you said, it's a mixed bag. I think the thing that I was struck by trying to kind of sort out what ended up in there is there's lots of like good changes that are done through bad process. Like a lot of housing policy has very sticky federalism problems, like which entity is the place where the authority should reside. And this bill moves that authority up and down on different subjects. And there's also a lot of like deregulating, but for stuff that already gets subsidies. And so it's like the deregulation is good, but also maybe the subsidies are now going to be easier to get in fraudulent or sloppy ways. The best bit,
but not,
according
one
to...
One thing about this bill that we should point out is that, just on that note, is that there are not... This is not a big, expensive bill. This is not a new subsidies bill where it's like this has a big price tag where it's like, oh, we have a housing problem, therefore giant number of dollars to solve housing.
This is what I mean about the bar being so low, though. Like, the could have been worse of this bill is substantial. Absolutely could have been worse. Yeah. So, for example, there's like some restrictions on investors buying single family homes and renting them out or whatever. But initially, the proposal was to like almost completely ban build to rent developments entirely. And to really radically cap and force divestment for investors who are owning single family homes. So like, this is okay. Could have been worse. Getting rid of the rules for manufactured.
I would actually say that provision is not good. It's just that the earlier version was much worse. Yes.
The getting rid of the rules for manufactured housing, like you used, there just used to be this rule. You had to have basically a way to move your trailer, even if the trailer wasn't really going to be a trailer. And getting rid of that makes sense. Like there's some good, you know, there's some good stuff in there. And it's a law that they did by the lawmaking process.
Nick, are you impressed with Congress? Do we give them two cheers here for passing a law that doesn't have a giant dollar sign attached to it and even does a little tiny bit of deregulation, kind of, sort of, here and there?
No, I wouldn't give them two cheers. That's at least one too many. It's nice to see them pass something. It's worrying that it was so unanimous, right? Because the closer you get to that, you figure, okay, there's something, either this is purely symbolic or it's purely evil. But to me, the big takeaway from all of this is the discussion of housing affordability and all of that. I went back and I looked at the St. Louis Fed's numbers of housing starts. And in the 1970s, for a variety of reasons that we can go into or not, but there per 1,000 person, there were about 10 or 11 housing starts per per annum. We're down to between 3 and 4. And it's been going down over the past couple of years. It dropped a lot after 2006 with the housing bust. But, you know, this is the problem, right? Like we all know, regardless of it's renting or if it's owning or whatever, like if you don't increase the supply of something and demand is steady or growing, prices are going to go up. And we are building like a third as many houses as we were 50 years ago in a country with many fewer people. With 100 million fewer people, what are we doing about that? And I don't think, to my mind, this bill, it doesn't hurt that, but it doesn't really address it or help it. And now suddenly we're in like bizarro discussions of like, well, it's really bad if, private equity is buying houses and they're, there's, big corporations own less than a 1% of all houses in America. And yet somehow that's the big thing. And that was partly Trump is obsessed with that. But it's like, this to me, if we're only building a third as many houses as we were 50 years ago, that's what we have to address. I'm not sure that it's Congress that does that, other than stripping out even more federal environmental reviews of housing, which would be good. But states like California, they're fucking up their housing market all on their own without any federal help.
I will say, as a committed, as a renter of a single family home, I appreciate that this law is at least, catered to my interests. So thanks. Yeah.
Matt, Nick said that he was worried that this was nearly unanimous, but obviously there's like a one significant holdout here. President Donald Trump, who refused to sign the law. He didn't veto it, however. So the way this works is if you just don't sign a law that is passed in Congress, you just wait it out. After like 10 days or 2 weeks, it becomes law. And that's what happened here, right? And in fact, Trump had a bunch of nice things to say about the housing bill about a month ago, and then he flipped. He flipped because he's mad at Congress, and specifically at Republicans in Congress, for not passing the SAVE Act, which is this sort of change to how voting works law that we're going to talk about with a listener question in just a minute. But Matt, what do you make of this kind of the weird Trump holdout tantrum thing that happened with this?
The most disturbing aspect of that is what Nick alluded to, is that Trump wanted to insert this stupid ban on private equity firms buying and selling rental units. Like, what are you talking about? It's a reminder that his economic instincts are rotten and that he's about the worst person you can imagine to lead the fight against democratic socialism when he's out there coming up with ideas like this and taking, you know, ownership stakes of AI companies and being a one-man tariff tree. It's just, it's awful. That making this a petulant thing about the SAVE Act is pretty classic. The SAVE Act is the Trump and Republican approach towards the SAVE Act is one of the great acts of kind of pre-election copium that we've seen in a really long time. Based Mike Lee is out there saying, like, if, you know, the election is bad and the midterms in November, we might never have another one because we didn't pass the SAVE Act. It's like, oh, or could be a second term president and his midterm elections lost a lot because he's really unpopular. And so are his policies. So
that would be new and unprecedented.
Precedented by every president except for Bill Clinton. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the SAVE Act because we have a listener question on it that is relevant here. Before we get to the question, a reminder as always that we love to answer questions from our listeners. If you have a question for the roundtable, please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long question to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. So like I said, this is a question about the SAVE Act, and it comes from John, who writes, "Esteemed podcast hosts, with MAGA and DSA populism now taking over both the Republican and the Democratic parties, could the SAVE Act's onerous requirements to vote have the unintended benefit of making it too difficult for uninformed populist-leaning citizens to register? This would leave only people who are well-informed and motivated enough to jump through the required hoops to vote the effective electorate. Would this allow a real libertarian moment? Or is this just monkey paw bait, libertarian moment, name check, Nick? What do you think?"
Yeah, I think it's monkey paw bait.
All right.
The SAVE Act, you know, I keep thinking as I read about this, because this is supposed to end the reign of all sorts of illegal people or non-eligible people voting in elections and, you know, destroying our fair republic and everything. And it's like, even the Heritage Foundation cannot come up with any incidents where, you know, fake voters overturned an election or, you know, they have like 70 incidents over, you know, 1,000 years of like voter fraud, period. And it's not even like
a big deal. Happy birthday, America. Again,
I'm just saying, like, the way that people talked about net neutrality, Ajit Pai said, you know, it's a solution to a problem that it's a solution that won't work to a problem that doesn't exist. That's my feeling about the SAVE Act in general. And as Matt was saying, it's like pre-copium, where it's like, we know we're going to lose big and we got to come up with a reason to kind of undergird the next level of paranoia, conspiracy thinking about elections that we get blown out in for obvious reasons. And you know, the damn shame is just that this used to be a Democratic thing. It was in 2004, there was a specter haunting the Democratic Party and the kind of left-wing intelligentsia that Bush had, you know, pre-programmed or you know, dragged magnets across Diebold election machines in Ohio to swing the election his way. And it was all insanity. And somehow that went through the garbage pit and came out as like Trump's main, you know, talking point about elections he wins or loses. They're always destroyed by these hordes of illegals and vote, you know, ballot harvesters who exist nowhere except in Candace Owens' fever dreams. So it's a waste of time.
I figured out that 2004 election conspiracy theory was really led by RFK Jr., who's now the Secretary of Health and Human Services in a Republican administration. Congratulations.
So you're not seeing the upside to the SAVE Act, Matt? You don't think this is going to create the libertarian moment?
I think that looking for miracle cures to create the perfect electorate is a path to madness and just fantasy fiction. Like, there is no such thing as a perfect electorate. We're not going to vote our way out of this. And probably if the rules about that voting are written by very self-interested members of one of the two major political parties, it's probably not going to be very like even-handed and fair for the entire electorate, certainly for those of us who don't like those two major political parties. So what are we even talking about? No, you're not. This is not going to solve the thing at all. It's not going to come close. If it's a bad,
you know who, bill. You know who was very ready to endorse this approach? Me in 1998, when I was doing my final project for AP US government in high school, and we were randomly paired together in this class, and I ended up paired up with the only other kid who wasn't like a lefty Democrat in the class. And at the time, I was just, you know, I was a philosopher. I was just an objectivist. I was above these petty politics. But me and the one Republican kid got paired together, and it was supposed to be a project to increase voter turnout. And we submitted a project that was like, hear me out.
What if maybe we should did the opposite of that?
We shouldn't increase the turnout for low information voters. That was our thesis. And so we were like, all these get out the vote things are bad because it just makes people who know less show up to vote. That did not go super well then for me. And I don't think, in fact, that this would go super well for America.
What did you get? What'd you get on the project?
I think I've blacked out what I got.
Catherine got an A in the class. We all know
I got an A in the class.
Catherine got an A on everything.
One of the things that's fascinating is voter turnout is like spectacular through the roof. I mean, it turns out that the recipe for voter turnout is not instant enrollment when you, you know, when you get a drunk driving arrest or something. It's you create a world in which, you know, everybody hates each other and won't let their child marry somebody from another party. And then suddenly people start voting as if their whole world depended on it.
Yeah. So I would say I am looking for the way to create the libertarian moment, but increasing barriers to voter registration, sadly, probably in it.
And you're the person on this podcast who kind of recommends people maybe shouldn't vote, right?
Right. But it's got to be voluntary, man. Yeah. It's got to be up to you.
So the question, I want to finish this with Catherine, actually for you, but maybe also for Matt and Nick, is does this increase your concern level about election shenanigans, about stuff that's more than even what we've seen before, you know, with Rudy Giuliani having a press conference in front of the Four Seasons, except it turns out it's a lawn company, right? With more than, I mean, because last time the election shenanigans, it was silly, it was ridiculous, and it ended in January 6th. And people are worried that, yes, you know, that like Trump is in theory not going to be running for a third term here. But over the next couple of years, the Republican Party will have kind of taken this sort of way of thinking about elections, like will have, you know, into their head and like said, that's what we're going to do from now on. And it seems like if you're going to prioritize something like the SAVE Act, it's an excuse for why you're going to lose. But maybe it's also a predecessor to something more.
It could be. I think that this is one place where I actually take some solace from the gerontocracy, because I actually just think so much of this is centered on, again, Trump's specific preferences and his sort of weirdly deep commitment to believing that elections are fraudulent, even the ones that he wins. And we didn't talk about Mitch McConnell today, but we published a piece at Reason last week saying the whole Mitch McConnell situation, he's very unwell, he's missing, he's, you know, maybe he's alive, maybe he's dead. The weekend at Bernie's conversation of the last week, we ran a piece saying like, yeah, this is more evidence of why we should be concerned about the very, very elderly running the country. But I do think there's a little bit of like, après moi le déluge. Like, Trump simply isn't going to fight to the death on the next election because he's too old and he can't take it.
Well,
that
it wasn't Trump
prediction.
Who fought to the death last time. It was,
I understand.
I mean, and look, nobody, right.
It's
it wasn't
led
to the
by,
death, but it was, there were people who were rallying to his cause.
Yes, but it was led by a Trumpian worldview and a Trumpian kind of aesthetic and people who are energized by Trump. And I do think those things are and will be on the decline. That's my best case.
to follow up on that, it's also, it's good then that the Republicans refuse to, you know, play this game. You know, that's what Trump is pissed about. And they're just like, hey, you know what? You're going to eat this one. And what's he going to do? You know?
He's going to not sign the housing bill, but it's going to become law anyway. All right. In his question, John mentioned the Democratic Socialists of America. So let's talk a little bit about DSA World and the Democrats right now, because one of DSA's great hopes is no longer running. Last week, Graham Plattner, the other Graham in our news this week, the Democratic Senate nominee for Maine.
That, by the way, that's a tell that this is a simulation, right? That's like an Easter egg or something.
I was just trying to work up some kind of s'mores joke. Like,
yeah,
if there's two Grahams, it's a...
It's like a Jeopardy thing before and after or something, you know, like Graham Cracker, Plattner or something.
Yeah.
I don't
that's
know.
True.
Well, let's have some s'more discussion of this issue. Yep. He announced he's going to be suspending his campaign and dropping out of the race after an accusation of rape, which, of course, followed other accusations of sexual misconduct from some of his ex-girlfriends. Nick, I just want to know what you make of this entire debacle here, because it seems like this is just a mess and also like a lesson in the kind of crappiness and the problems of socialist, sort of DSA-style populist politics?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think what it shows in a more limited way is that when you have somebody like a 10,000-year-old Dowager senator in Susan Collins, it's hard to get quality candidates, established quality candidates against her. You know, and they were even trying to run the former governor of Maine, who wasn't doing very well. And so in those circumstances, you know, you reach for, you know, a long shot, I think. And Plattner played that role well. I think what's very good is, and the Wall Street Journal was, and the Free Beacon has also done some great work on looking at the, you know, the trilogy or the trio of consultants who brought Plattner to the voting, you know, to the electorate. And hopefully those people will never hear from them again with their awful vocal fry and all of that kind of stuff. But I don't think this speaks to the DSA, you know, and to the idea of democratic socialists working hard in places like New York to win elections. We'll see how that plays in Michigan. There's a bunch of other places, like more in the heartland. But I think what the Plattner, you know, what Plattner shows, and it's usually Republicans, I think, who fall for kind of celebrity-ish candidates who are completely unprepared, terrible.
Well, he wasn't
candidates.
A celebrity.
Yeah,
he was
no,
an anti-celebrity,
an
right? Like he was somebody who
was.
Yes.
He's,
oh, absolutely.
He, you know,
totally
so
agree.
That's what I mean is like he. I was thinking of people like Herman Cain, you know, or Ben. What's his name?
Hurst. Who said?
Ben Carson, thank you. Like where they're not celebrities per se, but these are the people who will fix it. And Republicans love people like that. Democrats love people like this, right? And this shows the limitations of that because nobody in their right mind should have believed, you know, Graham Plattner was for real. Everything around him, all the people around him said he was a piece of shit. He's a liar. The media was compliant in a lot of this because they want somebody like that. But I think in a way this shows, however gross, you know, in however a gross way is possible, the system kind of works. You know, like when you bring somebody like that to full view, you know, you see them for what they are.
Matt, what do you think of this recruitment process? Go ahead, Catherine.
No, I just was going to do a little meta commentary on the things that cause Nick to say the system kind of works.
Yeah.
Are like, I would like to assemble a collection for us, because the things that come to my mind include like the Supreme Court stopping the absolute worst for Trump's immigration policy, maybe like January 7th or something. And then also
the one day that Lindsey Graham was against Trump.
Like I see what you're saying, and you're not necessarily wrong.
The internet fact-checked Graham Plattner's ass. Right.
Yeah,
on some level.
And
eventually the mainstream media, because for all the shit that the New York Times is taking for soft peddling what a piece of junk he was, that story is the reason why people are like, oh, yeah, this we need to get rid of him.
Matt, the system worked, right?
No, the system. No, I'm not actually here to dispute Nick's characterization, but rather to say that we're in this sad state of affairs where all you have to do is be kind of moderately charismatic or fit what Michelle Goldberg from the New York Times said, the aesthetics of working class.
Yeah.
And you match that with...
Which means getting kicked out of Hotchkiss, not graduating from an elite private prep school.
You twin that with absolutely boilerplate, send me to sleep nonsense about billionaires and the elite. And then you prattle on about Israel and one or two other sort of talking points of the day that are excite people on the left. And people who are supposed to be adults, whether in politics or especially journalism. And my God, did we have a lot of just amazing puff profiles, including after some of the original revelations about him being a shitbag liar, certainly about his Nazi tattoo that he'd had for a really long time.
It could happen to anybody.
And that was a Freikorps really tattoo, maybe, you know.
And the reaction by people who were otherwise supposed to be smart was just like, you know, I guess I let my enthusiasm get the best of me. I mean, I challenge anybody, and I made this, I guess, mistake when I first heard Donald Trump speak in 2015 at Freedom Fest, is that I just assumed that anyone who sat through an entire Trump speech would go, okay, no, we're just not going to be doing that. So I was wrong. And I'm similarly wrong about the Democratic Party right now, because when I heard Graham Plattner speak for 30 seconds ever, uninterrupted, I'm like, holy hell no. My God, are we kidding here? And yet that boilerplate is what excites Democrats now, and not just the DSA cadre of idiots in the place that I live, but in Maine, and it looks like in Michigan and in Colorado. So that's a system that's producing some really lousy candidates and policy. And I tremble to reflect that God is just.
On the aesthetics issue, it is great to think if Graham Plattner ran a hot dog stand, right? People would be like, he's a piece of shit from the get-go. And instead, he's somehow in like an organization that is obsessed with identity politics and everything. He was selling the whitest food, like the whitest white person food to his mother's restaurant. And that's what, oh, you know, like listening to him, you can smell the brine, you know, on his fingertips and stuff.
Oh, no.
And like,
you know, he's got to, I mean, people wrote about it, like, oh, he's got the hands of a working man. And it's like, what kind of lab created, you know, Persian cat, you know, that can't stand on its own feet because it's so overbred, do you have to be to fall for that kind of stuff? It just, it's awful.
So he was a bartender in D.C. In the H Street area, Capitol Hill area. And I'm pretty sure that at least a couple of times he was my bartender a decade or so ago when he was hanging out. If I recall correctly, he actually introduced me to a pretty good rye whiskey. At the time I was just like, oh, you know, all the bartenders in D.C., it's funny. They're all like getting master's degrees in poli-sci. Of course, this is normal in Washington, D.C., but maybe it's not that normal. Catherine, closing question on Graham Plattner here is we've talked about him as a sort of aesthetic creature, right? He was cast in a role to play a part. Was there anything remotely like substance, policy, a governing agenda? And so what was it?
I actually don't know. And I think that's like, you know, it's mostly an indictment of me, which is to say I just wasn't paying close attention to that race before it became entirely about who he is as a person rather than what he might have done as a politician. But yeah, I mean, I think there's, he contained within him some sort of AI-generated grab bag of public policy proposals and maybe a couple things he added from his master's degree / rye whiskey days in D.C. And, you know, I think we're all just very used to the kind of like reality show central casting type approach to politics. And we know that whatever people say on the stump, they're going to come to D.C. and they're either going to fall in line and vote with their party or they're going to be like a rare maverick type. And I'm just very uninterested in the people who fall in line and vote with the party. And we try to talk to and sometimes persuade the maverick types. I just didn't see any sign he was going to be one of those.
Yeah, I think there was some reporting to suggest that the people who recruited him, who were not affiliated with the Democratic Party, kind of independent recruiters, that their basic position is we want candidates who have two positions. One is they got to be skeptical of Israel, right? They got to be like, Israel is kind of doing some genocide. Maybe you don't have to use the G word, but you got to get pretty close. And the other is you got to say you're for Medicare for all. You don't have to release a policy paper that explains what that means. You don't have to point to specific legislation. You don't have to have any detail, which is good because when you provide any detail for Medicare for all, it shows that it's a disaster that's totally unworkable, even in a place like Vermont. All you got to do is those two things. You got to be kind of skeptical of Israel, and you got to be for Medicare for all, and then you got to say you're for the working man. And that was Graham Platner. And I think that is the state of not just sort of DSA-style politics, but a lot of the Democratic Party today. All right, let's move on to our final segment, our cultural recommendations, what we have been reading, watching, listening to, and otherwise consuming in the cultural realm. Matt Welch, you've been watching some sports ball? Sorry.
Yes, I've been watching sports ball for months, and it's great because it's all distracted me from ever having to watch the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim play ever again.
Wait, I'm sorry. So, the sports distracted you from the other sports?
Yes. Yes.
Maybe the Angels can be relocated to Caracas, Matt. You know,
that would be intriguing. I don't know if they have the infrastructure.
Get them out of California. California's got enough going on.
Is Stephen Miller in favor of that?
Slide areas.
So yeah, I've been watching the World Cup. Every 4 years I watch soccer, and it's the World Cup. And this one is expanded. It's in America. There's been all of these delightful Euro travelers and other people tweeting and then not tweeting anymore, but talking about how delightful America is, and Norwegian people acting funny and Scots people acting funny on the streets of various cities. And then the actual soccer has been really great and really fun. A lot of exciting matches and a lot of great players playing great. It's down to the now semifinals, which are happening Tuesday and Wednesday. And it's just been delightful. I even have talked myself into liking some of the broadcast team of Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Thierry Henry and horrible Alexi Lalas.
Why
is Alexi Lalas?
Did you just have a stroke?
He's a New Jersey boy. What's the problem with him?
I think your question answered itself.
Asked and answered.
He's a human superfund site.
Yes, with a voice box. But it's just been delightful, and I highly recommend it. Catch if you haven't watched any of it. You get to see France against Spain and England against Argentina. So, I mean, just all kinds of geopolitical fun coming up. But it's just been terrific, and I don't have to watch baseball, so that's great. The end.
The coverage of the Tartan Army coming to Boston has been pretty incredible, about how they're drinking Boston dry. And I want to emphasize Boston. When people in Boston are impressed by how much you drink, it's time to go to Catherine.
I wanted to spread the rumor that was actually like a Mario Lito program, that Scotland was just emptying its mental institutions in prison. But the Scottish fans are remarkably well behaved now, and they were, you know, patient zero in the great international soccer hooligan freakout of the 90s.
So they're drinking like crazy, but they're also, and then they're like trashing areas of Boston, but also cleaning up after themselves. And this is the story every time is, we just came and we got wrecked and we trashed this public park. And then by morning it was perfectly clean, like much cleaner than the city would have made it. Great. This is how it should work, Catherine. That's why we don't need public parks, right, Catherine? That's my actual question to you.
Yes, always. I watched a movie that's like, I don't know, over 10 years old, called About Time. It is If Love Actually Met the Time Traveler's Wife. It's a rom-com. It's schlocky. It's very delightful. I'm just saying, if you're in a bad mood, if you need a little mood lifter, this little movie, which is written by the same dude who wrote Four Weddings and a Funeral and Bridget Jones's Diary and Notting Hill, like it's, you know, has a solid pedigree. But you also want your movie to have a little time heist in it. This is the one. It was selected for me by Claude. I was like, hey, Claude, I need to watch a movie. And Claude did a great job. The lesson of the movie is, in fact, you should pause and take a minute and deeply appreciate the good things in your life. So, you know, I don't have anything cute and spicy and cynical to say. It was lovely.
Was about it time. Prompted by something? Were you on the way to the hospital or something when you...
I just was like, give me a movie that's going to make me feel good. And it worked. So, but yes, of course, we have had the Love Actually discourse on this podcast many times, and we do not need to have it again. But
it's Matt's favorite movie.
We finished watching it, and I was like, was that from the Love Actually guy? Because it very, very much has that texture while also having time travel. Very good.
So I watched a movie that's kind of the opposite of that. It's called The Invite, and it is a new movie from director Olivia Wilde. And this is a play-like film with basically just one setting and four characters. Stars Wilde, who is married to Seth Rogen in an increasingly agitated and bad kind of elder millennial marriage. And then Penelope Cruz and Edward Norton, who are their neighbors, who are a couple who are together but not married. And we kind of learn about all of these folks because they gather for a dinner party in Rogen and Wilde's home apartment. And this is a contemporary sex comedy. Or maybe a dramedy, because it does get a little bit heavier towards the end. And it's about marriage and complicated modern relationships and the ways that, like, communication just breaks down inside a relationship. And when it can be built back up, that can be great. And the acting's really great. It's especially Norton, who is, I don't want to spoil it too much, but let's just say there are some unexpected things about him and some of the facial reactions, right? Just like the kind of the commentary on the scene from his face. The only time I've ever seen any better is like when I'm watching Catherine Mangu Ward on this podcast. Because like you could just tell all the, right? It's like, I don't need words there. I just, you watch up, it's perfect, right? But Wilde's direction is really what makes this movie. It is so exceptional. Movies in a small confined space are really hard to pull off, right? Typically, you just want to do that on stage. And this is just the shots, the blocking. It's so crisp, often so funny and so psychologically revealing, right? You get to know these characters by the way they inhabit space, by the way they move around, by the way they are framed inside this like perfectly decorated, kind of downwardly mobile, aspirational, bougie San Francisco apartment. And then, of course, the way the neighbors are like looking around it and the way they kind of subtly, right, the way they react to everything in this space. And so I think there's just a lot going on here. Reason folks will be interested because it paints a really compelling and sympathetic picture of alternative sexual arrangements inside a relationship. And I don't know if this is a truly great movie, but it's a very good one. And it is a rare thing to see at movie theaters these days. It's not just a big screen comedy or a big screen romance. It is a smart and probing movie focused on contemporary adult lives and relationships. Strongly recommend Olivia Wilde's new movie, The Invite. And with that, I will invite Nick Gillespie to tell us what he has for us.
So I made the mistake of watching the new Larry David HBO series, Life, Larry, and the Pursuit of Unhappiness, which is basically Drunk History, except the audience wants to be drunk and needs to be drunk to get through a single episode. It is god-awful sketch comedy where Larry David is just being Larry, like Larry from the middle to end
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I love that show. It's one of my favorite Larry David performances.
Thank you. Yeah. What is the Larry David show?
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Thank you. Wow, that's like a major arterial blockage. But it is like...
Do you need to go to the hospital before you appear on
Press? I want to finish the podcast first, and then I've got a couple of other hits that I want to do before
I go to the emergency room. You got a war to start before you go to the hospital? Yeah.
No, but it is like... it is just a terribly unfunny show that is painful to watch, and particularly because it's got great production values and great cast, you know, people in it, you know, John Hamm is one of the Wright brothers in a, you know, particularly unfunny sketch. There's one about the McCarthy hearings. Like, it is abysmally bad. And because I don't drink anymore, there is no way that I could get through this. So I just would tell people to wait until you are totally drunk or high or about to have major surgery or and under sedation before you watch Life, Larry, and the Pursuit of Unhappiness. Just
do you
terrible.
Recommend any drugs to go along with this for the other abstainers in our
I would think some kind of date rape drug where you just black out and have no memory.
Just a little Scotia, the Rohypnol to get you through it.
Something like that. Yeah, sure. Or Roofie. Rohypnol would probably be right up there.
If you do it to yourself, I suppose that's consent. Okay, that's right. Our show. Oof. If you like our podcast and if you like Reason, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That is reason.com/donate. Thank you, as always, for listening. Reason Roundtable will return.